Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Whenever we sit down to look at a new stack of sources, I always think about you, the listener.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you're here because you want to cut through that overwhelming daily avalanche of information. You're looking for the signal in the noise, those genuine moments where complex pieces of the puzzle just suddenly snap together. And the source material we have on the table today is incredibly dense, but it offers a really fascinating lens on some very recent global events.
It really does. I mean, the document we're analyzing today is a long-form editorial published right around now in March 2026.
Right.
It's titled The Great Narco-Hypocrisy, and it's written by a man named Brent Lambie.
And his background is pretty key here, right?
Yeah, it is. To give you some context on him, he holds a BA in accounting from the University of Northern Iowa.
Class of 82, I think.
Class of 82, exactly. And a law degree from Creighton University, class of 85. So he's both an accountant and an attorney.
Which is important.
Very important, because he approaches his arguments with a really specific focus on legal frameworks and financial ledgers. He's looking at the numbers and the law.
Okay, but before we get into the details of his argument, we really need to pause for a very important disclaimer.
Yes, definitely.
Because the document we are unpacking today is fiercely political. It makes aggressive claims about current and past U.S. presidential administrations.
It touches on multiple sides of the political spectrum.
It does. And we want to emphasize to you right up front that we are absolutely not taking sides here.
No, not at all.
We aren't endorsing Lambie's political viewpoints, and we aren't condemning them either. Our mission for this deep dive is simply to act as your analytical guides.
Exactly. Our goal is just comprehension of the source material.
We're going to impartially unpack the arguments, the legal claims, and the data that Lambie presents, so you can fully understand the architecture of his specific perspective on U.S. drug policy.
We want to look at how he builds his case piece by piece, regardless of whether you ultimately agree with his conclusions.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this. Lambie's central driving thesis is that the American public has been fed what he calls a fire and brimstone rhetoric regarding the war on drugs.
Yeah, that's his term for it.
He points out that we are constantly told by politicians that drug dealers are, quote, social predators. We hear the standard campaign trail rhetoric demanding the absolute ultimate penalties.
Right, maximum sentences, locking them up, and throwing away the key.
Exactly.
What?
But Lambie argues that the current administration's actual policy actions represent a, well, he calls it a lawless exercise of ego and a cynical bloody hoax.
Those are strong words.
Very strong. And he starts building this case by examining the use of executive clemency.
And right here, I think it's worth taking a second to define the terms Lambie is using, because as a lawyer, he's being very precise.
Please do.
So clemency is the umbrella term for the president's constitutional power to show leniency.
Okay.
Under that umbrella, you have a pardon, which essentially wipes away the conviction as if it never happened.
A clean slate.
Exactly. And then you have a commutation, which leaves the conviction intact, but reduces or totally eliminates the punishment.
Got it.
And Lambie argues that these powers are currently being used as get-out-of-jail-free cards, and not for low-level offenders who fell through the cracks of the justice system.
Right, which is what you'd maybe expect.
Yeah, but for the literal architects of the global narco-state.
And he dedicates a huge portion of his editorial to what he calls a hall of fame for kingpins.
The hall of fame, yeah.
He doesn't just make a broad philosophical complaint here.
No.
He brings receipts. He focuses on specific, heavily documented cases from 2025.
Let's get into those.
The first one he highlights is Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras.
Yes. Hernandez was granted a full pardon in December of 2025. And Lambie highlights the specific facts of his conviction to really illustrate the scale we're talking about here.
It's massive.
It is. Hernandez wasn't just adjacent to the drug trade. He was previously sentenced to 45 years in federal prison.
45 years.
For conspiring to import 400 tons of cocaine into the United States.
400 tons. I mean, when you stop and think about the logistics of moving 400 tons of anything, let alone illicit narcotics,
yeah,
it is an industrial scale operation.
It's staggering. Furthermore, Lambie emphasizes that federal prosecutors proved Hernandez actively used the Honduran military and national police force to protect those drug shipments.
He was using the actual military.
Yes, he was a head of state utilizing his nation's sovereign armed forces to facilitate international narcotics trafficking.
And yet, he gets a pardon.
Yet he was granted a pardon just as his political allies back home were seeking his return to power.
Wow. And Lambie is clearly using this to shock the reader. But he doesn't stop there. He moves on to a completely different type of kingpin.
Right. He cites the case of Ross Ulbricht, the founder of the dark web marketplace known as Silk Road.
A very famous case.
Extremely famous. Ulbricht was serving a life sentence, but he received a full pardon in January 2025.
And Lambie makes a specific point about the mechanism of the crime here, doesn't he?
He does. He points out that Silk Road wasn't just a website. It was highly sophisticated, anonymized infrastructure that facilitated over $200 million in illegal drug sales.
$200 million.
And more importantly, to Lambie's argument, he notes that the Department of Justice directly linked the specific narcotics sold on that platform to multiple fatal overdoses.
Okay, so that's two wildly different profiles.
Yeah.
A foreign president and a tie founder. And then Lambie brings in a third example, one deeply rooted in American organized crime.
Larry Hoover.
Larry Hoover, the founder of the Gangster Disciples.
Hoover's federal life sentence was commuted in May of 2025. And again, Lambie focuses on the sheer scale of the enterprise.
It wasn't just a street gang.
Not at all. Under Hoover, the Gangster Disciples operated as a massive corporate syndicate, moving an estimated $100 million in drug sales annually.
And they had a very violent history.
A widely documented history of violence and murder across the entire country.
So if we look at what Lambie is trying to achieve with these three examples, Hernandez, Ulbricht, and Hoover, he is asking you to look at the extreme juxtaposition.
Exactly.
He's laying the public rhetoric, calling for maximum penalties for street-level dealers, right next to the stroke of a presidential pen, freeing men responsible for international conspiracies, hundreds of millions of dollars in sales, and systemic violence.
He is trying to establish a very clear pattern. And to cement this, Lambie includes a comparative chart in his editorial.
Right, the data.
He looks at the historical clemency records of three recent presidents to argue that the current administration's focus is a radical, totally unprecedented departure from historical norms.
Let's break down that chart because this is where his background as an accountant really shows. He's looking for trends in the data. How does he categorize the previous administrations?
Well, according to his analysis, if you look at Barack Obama's administration, the chart shows zero major drug kingpins pardoned. Zero. Lambie notes that Obama's clemency initiative was primarily focused on low-level, nonviolent crack cocaine offenders.
Okay, so a very different demographic.
Completely different. The stated policy goal there, as Lambie explains it, was fair sentencing. It was an attempt to retroactively correct the systemic and often racially disparate sentencing guidelines between crack and powder cocaine that were established back in the 1980s.
Okay, so that's a policy-driven use of clemency aimed at a class of people. What about Joe Biden?
Lambie's chart again shows zero major kingpins for the Biden administration.
Okay.
The focus there is listed as blanket pardons for simple marijuana possession. Lambie points out this was tied to a broader federal push toward decriminalization and rescheduling of cannabis.
Right, trying to align federal postures slightly closer to the growing number of states that had already legalized it.
Exactly. So again, a systemic, policy-driven use of the power.
But then Lambie shifts to the current administration, Donald Trump, in the context of this March 2026 editorial. How does he frame that data?
According to Lambie's chart, the number of high-level commutations and pardons jumps to over 100.
Over 100.
And he argues the primary focus is heavily weighted toward major drug kingpins, political allies, and high-level traffickers.
That's a massive shift.
It is. Lambie uses this historical contrast to argue that executive clemency has shifted from a tool of systemic, policy-based correction into a tool of individualized executive impunity.
So why does this matter to you? Because in Lambie's view, it completely flips the script on what we fundamentally think of as law and order.
Yeah, it turns it upside down.
We are generally conditioned to believe that the higher up the criminal chain you go, the harder the justice system comes down on you.
Right.
But Lambie is using this data to argue that the system is currently functioning in reverse. His thesis here is that if you are big enough, or if your enterprise generates enough capital or political leverage, the standard rules of the justice system just simply evaporate.
And it's that specific argument, the idea of elite impunity, that Lambie uses as a transition into the darkest, most legally complex section of his editorial.
Yeah, this part is intense.
He basically asks the reader, if the architects in the drug trade are walking free out of the front door of federal prisons, what is the administration doing to the people at the very bottom of the ladder?
Here's where it gets really interesting, and where Lambie leans heavily into his legal background. He titles this next section, the blood of the suspected.
The suspected.
Right. He pivots entirely away from the domestic justice system and focuses on a military initiative called Operation Southern Spear.
Yes. Lambie relies on Department of Defense briefings and recent investigative reporting to outline this operation. According to his sources, Southern Spear is a lethal maritime strike campaign.
Lethal strikes.
Yes. Active since September 2025 and operating primarily in the Caribbean and the Pacific.
And the numbers he presents here stand in stark contrast to the pardons. He states that at least 115 people have been killed by drone strikes. But the crux of his legal argument hinges on that single word, suspected. These strikes are targeting vessels that are merely suspected of drug smuggling. Does Lambie explain how the military justifies this and why he believes it's illegal?
He does, and this requires us to look at the specific legal mechanisms he cites. From the administration side, Lambie notes they are labeling these targets as narco-terrorists.
Narco-terrorists.
Right. They are attempting to place them under the umbrella of authorized military force rather than civilian law enforcement.
Because military force has different rules of engagement.
Exactly. But Lambie, speaking as an attorney, fundamentally rejects this. He points out that in these strikes, there are no maritime interdictions.
Meaning they aren't stopping the boats.
No. The Coast Guard or Navy isn't boarding the ships. There are no arrests. There are no cargo manifests recovered from the bottom of the ocean.
So no proof.
Crucially, no narcotics are actually seized to definitively prove the boats were carrying drugs at all. The military orders, as he describes them, bypass all of that and go straight to lethal force.
Just blow them up.
Basically, yes.
And he specifically cites the United Nations Charter here, right? How does that apply?
He cites the UN Charter, specifically Article 2. This article is the absolute bedrock of international law regarding state sovereignty and the restriction of the use of force.
What does it say?
Essentially, it says nations cannot unilaterally use military force against the territorial integrity or political independence of another state.
Okay.
Lambie argues that blowing up vessels in international or foreign waters, vessels that are often flagged to other sovereign nations without an imminent threat of violence, is a direct violation of international law.
But he also brings the argument back to domestic U.S. law. He brings up the Constitution.
Yes. He argues this is a blatant violation of the U.S. Constitution's Fifth Amendment.
Due process.
Exactly. The Fifth Amendment guarantees due process. The principle that the government cannot deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. This traditionally means a fair trial, the right to examine evidence, and the right to defend oneself.
But wait, does the Fifth Amendment apply to foreign nationals on boats in the middle of the ocean?
That is often a legally gray area, yes. But Lambie's argument is that when the U.S. government is the entity executing the lethal force, especially outside of a declared traditional war zone, it cannot simply circumvent the core tenets of American justice by labeling someone a terrorist without providing any evidence.
And the families of the victims are speaking out, aren't they?
They are. He points out that human rights organizations and the families of the deceased are coming forward. Without a shred of evidence produced post-strike, these families are arguing that the dead aren't cartel operatives at all.
Who do they say they are?
They are saying they're missing fishermen or migrants, people who have been executed by drones without ever seeing a courtroom.
Wow. It's a devastating structural comparison Lambie is making here. He's asking you to look at the guy moving 400 tons of cocaine with a military escort who gets a personalized pardon in the Oval Office. Then he asks you to look at a suspected deckhand on an unverified fishing boat who gets vaporized by a Hellfire missile.
Yeah.
He is arguing that this isn't a justice system. It's a profound contradiction.
And that contradiction is the perfect setup for what Lambie calls the crowning irony of his entire piece.
The crowning irony.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, if the administration is simultaneously freeing drug lords and bombing suspected low-level smugglers, what is the actual goal of their international policy?
Which brings him to the recent geopolitical news regarding Venezuela.
Exactly.
Right, the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January 2026. This was a massive international event, a literal military invasion.
Yeah, it was huge.
And it was publicly cloaked in the exact same rhetoric we discussed earlier, the war on narco-terrorism. But Lambie argues that the invasion is actually a blatant resource grab.
And what's critical here is that Lambie doesn't just base this on cynical speculation. He isn't making a leap of faith.
No, he points to their own words.
He points directly to the administration's own admitted motives, which were openly stated in press briefings, and he cites them in his text.
What exactly did they admit to?
Lambie highlights that the administration publicly declared its intention to tap into Venezuela's nationalized oil reserves to, quote, self-finance the military mission and subsequent occupation.
Self-finance.
Yes. And he emphasizes the scale of the economics involved here. Venezuela sits on roughly 300 billion barrels of proven oil reserves.
300 billion.
It is the single largest proven reserve on the planet.
From an accounting perspective, that is an astronomical economic prize. And this is where Lambie's anger really crystallizes in the text. The administration is essentially overthrowing a foreign government and occupying Caracas under the banner of stopping drug kingpins.
Right.
But simultaneously, they are announcing plans to extract the nation's primary economic resource to pay for the privilege.
Lambie argues that this openly stated financial goal unmasks the entire war on drugs narrative as a convenient facade. His logical progression is this: if the genuine primary goal of the administration was law enforcement and dismantling the drug trade, you fundamentally would not be pardoning convicted, confessed cartel architects back home in Washington.
Right. The logic doesn't hold up.
By linking the military actions so overtly to the extraction of foreign resources, Lambie believes the administration has essentially confessed that the true motive in Venezuela isn't opioids, it's oil.
So what does this all mean? When we pull all these threads together, the clemency data, the maritime drone strikes, and the invasion of Venezuela.
Yeah.
What does Lambie synthesize this into?
Well,
he concludes that the message the United States is currently projecting to the world is incredibly stark. He writes that if you are a high-ranking dictator with political capital or a kingpin with powerful leverage, the president will happily open your cell door.
They walk free.
But if you are a suspected nameless deckhand, or if you simply happen to be a citizen of a sovereign nation sitting on a massive, highly desirable oil reserve, you face military violence.
He summarizes the current state of affairs as a system that treats the federal justice system as a personal toy for the executive branch.
A personal toy.
And the U.S. military as a corporate raiding party. In his legal and financial estimation, it is a total and complete breakdown of logical, ethical, and legal consistency.
And to really underscore how utterly absurd he finds this lack of consistency, Lambie injects some incredibly dark, sarcastic humor right at the very end of his editorial.
Yeah, footnote.
I actually have to read you the final footnote of his piece because he formats it entirely in all caps, and it's just bizarrely striking.
Go for it.
He writes, "Is the proposed invasion of Greenland part of the war on drugs? Will the United States start killing Greenland boaters next? Greenland is a well-known narco state. Does Greenland use seals as drug mules?"
Huh? Yeah, does Greenland use seals? It's an absurd joke, obviously.
Very absurd.
But strategically, it perfectly encapsulates his view of the administration's policy. He is using absurdity to highlight what he sees as an utterly absurd framework.
It's a slippery slope argument.
Exactly. He is basically arguing a slippery slope. If a U.S. administration can invade Venezuela for oil and successfully justify it to the public as a drug war, what is stopping them from invading literally anywhere else using the exact same playbook?
Right.
Will we accuse Greenland's wildlife of trafficking just to justify a geopolitical move for Arctic resources?
The seal drug mules line is definitely dark humor, but the underlying anxiety he's expressing is very real. He's arguing that the stated legal justifications for massive, violent government actions have lost all their meaning.
This raises an important question, though, and it's one that builds purely on the constitutional facts Lambie has laid out about how our legal system interacts with the rest of the world.
That's the question.
Well, Lambie notes that presidential clemency is rooted in Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution. This clause gives the executive branch immense, practically unchecked and unreviewable power to pardon federal crimes. But if we take Lambie's argument seriously, we have to consider the long-term international ripple effects of using that absolute power on global narcotics cases.
How so? Walk me through the mechanics of that.
Think back to the case of Juan Orlando Hernandez. Bringing down an international drug trafficker of that magnitude, especially a former head of state, is not something the U.S. does alone.
No, it takes years.
It takes years, and it requires intense, incredibly dangerous international cooperation. It requires foreign allies sharing sensitive intelligence. It requires local law enforcement in those countries risking their lives and their families' lives to make the arrest.
They're putting everything on the line.
They are. And crucially, it relies on complex extradition treaties where a sovereign nation agrees to hand over one of its own citizens to the United States justice system.
Right. They are trusting our system to handle it.
Exactly. But if a U.S. administration can unilaterally pardon an international kingpin with a single signature, what happens to the future of global extradition treaties? If you are a foreign ally, a sovereign nation partnering with the DEA or the DOJ, why would you ever risk your own country's blood and treasure again?
You wouldn't.
Why would you risk the inevitable violent cartel retaliation to capture and extradite a kingpin to the United States, knowing that a simple stroke of a presidential pen could set them completely free?
Wow, because they could just go right back home.
Exactly. They could be sent right back to your doorstep entirely legally, often more powerful and certainly more vengeful than before.
That's terrifying.
The unilateral pardon power is a domestic constitutional right, but when it is used on international criminals, as Lambie argues it is being used now, it could completely dismantle the global trust, treaties, and alliances required to fight actual transnational organized crime.
That is a fascinating and honestly chilling thought to end on. It completely changes how you look at the power of the pardon. It ceases to be just a domestic political issue and becomes a massive global security vulnerability.
It really does.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's analysis. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources. We always appreciate your curiosity and your willingness to unpack the mechanics of these complex arguments with us. Keep questioning the noise, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.